in denial would immediately find worrisome. But because you are in the midst of it, the roots of every fear bend and break, reforming into plausible explanations that allow you to put off being concerned. Denial is forcing boring, pedestrian explanations out of your synapses, growing them thick and uncontrolled like vines on a time-lapse video, and doing it constantly and quickly so nothing logical has a chance to squeeze through. It just didn't occur to me that Sarah could be anywhere but where she had said she would be, or that the reason she wasn't answering her phone was because she A, wouldn't, or B, couldn't. But I realize now, this was all that was occurring to Jack. "Where is she staying?" he asked. "We'll call her there." I wondered what the urgency was. What couldn't wait? "Is everything okay, Jack?" I asked. "Is something wrong? Has something happened?" I wasn't getting it yet, but this was what was wrong. This was what had happened. After Jack hung up, I lay down and tried to go back to sleep, sure that he and Maureen were overreacting. But after less than a minute, I was staring at the ceiling and feeling responsible for their panic. I couldn't remember the name of the hotel where Sarah was staying. Truth be told, I couldn't remember whether she had ever told me. I imagined Jack and Maureen in their paisley-covered living room, Jack pacing back and forth in front of the fireplace, Maureen pulling the rosary beads she had bought in Lourdes through her fingers. It didn't matter that they didn't need to be worried, only that they were. Sarah would be devastated to find out what she had inadvertently caused with her radio silence. A silence quite likely intended to help me. This could be all my fault. I scrolled through the contacts on my phone until I found Rose's number. My call to her went unanswered. I sent her a text instead, asking whether she had heard from Sarah in the past couple of days, and if she hadn't, could she by any chance remember the name of the hotel in Barcelona where she was staying? They would be able to tell me the name of the hotel at the office. Jack and Maureen had probably just spoken to the receptionist, who could hardly be expected to know the whereabouts of every employee. 100 people worked at Sarah's firm. I could call them myself and make sure I got put through to her department, maybe even disguise it as a follow-up with my new best friend, Susan the Sudden Scribe Robinson, Sarah's manager. But then I pictured Sarah's face as I explained my reasons for calling her boss, and decided instead to wait and see if Rose knew the name of the hotel. Besides, Jack and Maureen had already been on at the office. Them and me in the same day? Sarah would be mortified when she got back. I padded into the living room and woke up my computer. Sarah had bought me a laptop a couple of Christmases ago. She had one of her own, but only mine was connected to a printer. I'd seen the icon on my desktop already. A PDF file named as a string of random numbers, Sarah's boarding passes. I opened them now. EU, EEA, passenger, Sarah O'Connell, booking reference EHJ9AM. 10 August 2014, EI802, ORKBCN, Zone B, seat 18B. Departs 10:55. Gate closes 10:25. EU EEA passenger Sarah O'Connell, booking reference EHJ9AM, 14 August 2014. EI804 BCN ORK, Zone C, seat 23A. Departs 11:40, gates close 11:10. I printed them off and set the page aside. Sarah would no doubt make contact any second, but seeing the boarding passes might make Jack and Maureen feel a bit better in the meantime. I might go over there later and do some reassuring in person, although Sarah would probably call long before then. I tried her number now, but after a beat of dead air, voicemail kicked in. Hi, you've reached Sarah, sort of, because I can't answer my phone right now. But please leave me a message and I'll call you back just as soon as I can. I hung up without saying anything. So her phone was dead. Or switched off, at least. I looked at my own mobile, turned it over in my hand, studied it. An item easily lost or damaged, kept alive by another item even more easily lost or damaged. If Sarah didn't have one, if every other person in the Western world didn't have one too, would Jack and Maureen be worried about their grown daughter right now? Would it be at all odd that she had been away for a couple of days and hadn't contacted them? As my father liked to say, what did we all do before mobile phones, eh? We waited for people to come home. How else could you contact someone if they didn't have their mobile phone? Sarah only ever emailed me links to articles she had found online and thought I would like, but I swiped a finger across my phone screen and checked my inbox just in case. All that had come in the past couple of days were circulars from online stores, notifications of new comments on my blog, and 3 hours ago, an email from my agent. The subject line said, rewrite? I ignored it for now, one problem at a time. I checked my Twitter and Facebook apps. Sarah had accounts on both, though she rarely used them. I saw that the most recent activity was from weeks before. Even if her phone was dead, she was bound to be online, if only for conference-related work stuff. I sent her private messages on both networks, then an email asking her to call me when she got the chance, telling her I missed her, reminding her that I loved her. Back to the home screen. Still nothing from Sarah, nothing from Rose. I sent Morsi a message asking him to ask Rose to call me. Then I realized there was a way I could find out where Sarah was staying. Possibly. The archive box was in my side of the wardrobe. Setting it on the bed, I rifled through utility bills, our lease, the finance agreement on my car. At the back was a bundle of bank statements and, stuck in the middle, the letter from Sarah's bank thanking her for registering for online banking and giving her the 8-digit code she needed to access it. Back in my computer, I navigated to her bank's homepage. After clicking away a series of pop-up ads, I found a link to access your personal account. I moved the cursor over it and hesitated. This was for Jack and Maureen, I told myself. I wanted to stick a pin in their panic, deflate the fear that was growing in that paisley-clad living room. Sarah would appreciate it. She would even forgive me for looking at her bank account. Wouldn't she? We didn't keep any secrets from each other anyway. We lived together, lived our lives together. How could we keep secrets? I clicked on the link and logged on to Sarah's online banking. The first thing that struck me was the balance on her current account. She had nearly 15,000 euro in there and another 5,000 in what looked like some kind of special savings scheme. I had less than 100 to my name. What was she doing with so much money? How did she have so much while keeping both of us afloat? I thought of our conversation about Barcelona. You can't afford it, she had said. You, not we. A few weeks ago, the flight might have been 100 euro, at most 150. What was that out of 15 grand? You wouldn't even miss it. But as soon as this thought formed, I felt my cheeks warm at shame. This was her money. She had earned it. Sarah certainly wasn't under any obligation to spend any more of it on me. I shook this discovery off and went looking for a list of recent transactions on Sarah's debit card. As soon as I found them, I knew that something was wrong. The narratives were all store and restaurant names I recognized. I knew them because they were all here, in Cork. They were all from before Sarah left for Spain. I could even see a charge from Brown Thomas, the store where she had bought the red dress on Saturday. She must have used the gift card I gave her for part of the payment. Apparently women's dresses cost a lot more than I thought. The exception was one charge from Sunday morning, something called HMS Host. The letters POS were displayed next to the transaction, meaning that it was a point of sale where Sarah had physically handed over her card at the cash register. I thought it might mean something until I Googled it and discovered that HMS Host was just the operator of the cafe in the departures lounge of Cork Airport. Sarah hadn't used her card abroad at all. How was that possible? Or was I just looking in the wrong place? I scanned the screen until I found a link to pending transactions. There were just two. 10/08/2014. VDA Aeropuerto BCN. 653.00DR. 10/08/2014. VDA Playa Princess HDL. 50.00DR. I opened another browser window, typed Playa Princess HDL Barcelona into Google and hit enter. Did you mean Playa Princess Hotel Barcelona? I found the hotel's contact information on its website and called the front desk. It rang only once before a recorded message in Spanish kicked in. Not understanding a word, I hit the standard option for getting a human being. Zero. Hotel Playa Princess, buenos dias, a female voice said. Ah, buenos dias, I said. Habla inglés, por favor? Yes, of course, sir. How may I help you? I'm trying to reach a guest of yours, Sarah O'Connell. Can you put me through to her room? I spelled the name. One moment, please. Tranquil hold music came down the line. Expecting to hear Sarah's voice next, I was gearing up to say something sarcastic about the whole point of having a mobile phone at all when, abruptly, the agent came back on the line. I am sorry, sir. We have no guest by that name. Are you sure? I spell the surname out again. Certain, sir. Perhaps she is in a different hotel? Maybe it's under her employer's name. I spelled out Anna Buckley Recruitment. Let me see. I could hear the soft clacking of computer keys. No, sir, I have nothing under that either. But she's definitely there, I said. You charged her debit card, €50, on Sunday. Why would there be a charge in her card if she's not staying there? Perhaps she dined here? A pause. Is there anything else I can assist you with today? Look, I said, lowering my voice, I don't want to get you into any trouble, but it's really important that I contact her. We have a bit of a family emergency here and she's not answering her phone. There came a long pause, then a barely audible sigh. One moment, please. I waited through more computer key clacking. Much more this time. Ah, okay, the agent said eventually. I think I found her. Sarah O'Connell arrived Sunday the 10th. That's her! An unexpected surge of relief flooded through me. Perhaps I'd been a little worried that this was about more than a dead phone or a lost charger. Great. Thank you. Can you put me through to her room? Miss O'Connell has already checked out. What? She stayed with us for only one night. I frowned. Are you sure? Yes, the agent said a little indignantly. Did she check out early, can you tell? Sir, I'm sorry. Do you have a conference on this week? No, we do not have the facilities. We are only a small boutique hotel of 35 rooms. I mumbled my thanks and ended the call just as my phone beeped with a message from Morsi. Rose had worked till 6. Everything okay? I wasn't sure. I had the name of Sarah's hotel, yes, but also confirmation that she had left it after just one night's stay. Why? Where had she gone then? Where was she now? Why hadn't she called or texted me? Why hadn't she called or texted her parents? Was it possible that she hadn't told them she was going to Spain? Why wouldn't she? What the hell was going on here? Before now, whenever I heard people say, "I didn't know what to think," I thought they meant I couldn't decide on a likely explanation from all the possibilities that were running through my head at the time. But now I understand that it's far more literal than that. You experience a blankness, an absence of thought. The voice in your head goes silent because your mind is so overloaded with fragments of information that make absolutely no sense. Thus, it fights them all at once, pushing them away until only a silent, empty space is left. The voice in your head goes away because it doesn't know what to say. It doesn't even know where to begin. You don't know what to think, so you think nothing at all. While we're on the subject, the same goes for weak at the knees. Love songs and rom-coms have us thinking that it's all to do with love and butterflies and joy. But it's actually what happens when you get such a shock, your brain momentarily forgets to keep telling your legs to stand, and you collapse, sliding or dropping straight to the floor and landing in a tangle with your legs underneath you. But that realization was still ahead of me. A few seconds of contact with Sarah would clear all this up. I glared at my phone, willing it to come alive with a call from her. I refreshed my email, willing a new message from her to appear. I picked up the printout of the boarding passes and studied it, willing the black print to reveal something to me I hadn't seen before. EU, EEA, passenger, Sarah O'Connell, booking reference, EH, J9AM, 10 August 2014, EI 802, ORK, BCN, Zone B, Seat 18B, departs 10:55, gate closes 10:25. EU, EEA passenger, Sarah O'Connell, booking reference, EH, J9AM, 14 August 2014, EI 804, BCN, ORK, Zone C, Seat 23A, departs 11:40, gate closes 11:10. And then it did. The first time I had looked at the boarding passes, I saw only what I had expected to see. That Sarah had been on the flight I dropped her off for on Sunday and was due to be on the one that would land at lunchtime 4 days later. But now I saw something else too. Something wrong. No. My phone began to vibrate, but it wasn't Sarah's name on the screen. Rose, I said flatly. Hey, Adam. Her voice was airy with artificial nonchalance. Morrissey said you were trying to reach me. I'm at work, but I'm on a break. What's up? You tell me. At least 5 full seconds of silence followed, then quietly, I'm not sure what you mean. She booked a middle seat, Rose. What? On her flight to Barcelona. B is a middle seat. Why would she do that? No one wants a middle seat. Unless, of course, you wanted to sit next to someone who had already booked the aisle or the window. I didn't have any answers yet, but I had just figured out one of the questions. Where's Sarah? Rose. My voice wavered, so I called on the added force of an expletive to steady it. And who the fuck is she with?
Romain, Dovia Picardie, 1989. All Romain wanted was to be a good little boy. According to Maman, Jean was the best little boy. This was clearly not true because Maman didn't know all the little boys in the world, and anyway, Jean wasn't really even good. He was just pretending. He did as he was told, just because he knew it would get him sweets or extra TV time. He wasn't actually good. Not inside. But Maman didn't seem to see this, and whenever Romain tried to tell her, she looked up at the ceiling and said, "If you only were half as good as your brother is." But she never finished the sentence, and so he didn't know what would happen if he was. Maybe that was why Jean felt so tired all the time. He and Romain shared bunk beds, and Jean was always asleep before Romain. And yet, every morning when Maman came to wake them up, Jean said he wanted to stay in bed longer and sleep more. Being good must be exhausting. The sweets Maman bought were the hard ones with no chocolate on them, and the TV didn't even have the children's channels with the cartoons. So why did Jean even bother pretending to be good? Romain couldn't figure it out. Papa worked in the city and was home only on weekends. Every Friday evening, Maman packed them all into the car and drove to Compiègne to collect Papa from the train station. This was Romain's favorite time of the week, because Papa was his favorite, and when he came walking out of the train station, it was the furthest moment from the moment when he would have to go back again. Sometimes, though, Maman ruined it. Papa would always drive back, and Maman would sit beside him and tell him about her week. She always talked about Romain as if he weren't sitting right behind her, listening. He did this, he wouldn't do that. I don't know what's wrong with that boy, but something is. Don't you see it? What are we going to do with him? What can we do? What can I do at home all week by myself? She was always going on about Félix, the Laurier's cat, even though she hated cats. Romain had seen her chase Félix out of their garden more than once. He had been missing for ages when she found the cat's collar in the fort Romain and Jean had built down by the lake. Maman must think Papa had a terrible memory because she told him the same story over and over again, and Papa always said the same thing. So what? That cat was always around the place. Maman said, yes, except that the collar hadn't been torn or cut, but carefully unbuckled and removed. Papa said she had an overactive imagination, and that furry lump of fat probably died of heart disease. Then he would tell her to stop going on about it because children understand more than you think. Then Papa would wink at Romain in the back seat, and whenever Mama caught him doing it, she would tell him he needed to decide whose side he was on. This Friday, though, she had something new to say.
"Ask him about the bird, why don't you?" she said to Papa. "Get him to tell you what happened to the bird. Then let's see who has an overactive imagination."
Yesterday was the first day without rain in a week. After being cooped up with Maman and Mickey and Jean in the house for so long, Romain was excited to get outside, to get away from them. He preferred the world when it was quiet. The path to the lake went past the old shed at the end of the garden where Papa kept things he never used. There was a big rusty lock on the door, and Romain and Jean knew they weren't allowed inside. At the back of the shed stood an old plastic rain barrel. As Romain passed it, he heard a strange flapping noise coming from inside. Splashing? Chirping? Romain had to stand on tiptoe to see over the lip of the barrel. It was a third full of greenish water and smelled funny, and a little bird was near the bottom of it, drowning. It looked like a robin, but Romain wasn't sure. He didn't know a lot about birds. He thought they liked water, but this one didn't seem to. Only its head and the ends of its wings were above the water, and it was chirping and flapping and hopping up and down, going crazy, trying to get out. Romain spent a few seconds thinking about what he could do. He could do nothing and carry on down to the lake, but then the bird would probably die. That wouldn't be very nice. He could try to find something to pull the bird out with, but he wasn't sure he was tall enough to do that. He could go get help, but if he told Maman about this, he'd probably get in trouble for it somehow. He always did. She'd find a way. How else could he get the bird out of the barrel? That's when Romain got the idea to pull the barrel over so all the water and the bird would come out. It took a while, because he wasn't strong enough to pull it over all by himself. In the end, he had to hang from the side of the barrel with his arms outstretched, pulling on it with all his weight before it tipped over. He tried to jump out of the way then, but the water came out fast. He felt it, cold and slimy, splashing against his legs. There was much more of it in there than he had thought, and it went everywhere in just a second, crashing out of the barrel and spreading all over the ground. Everything went quiet. Even the chirping had stopped. At first, Romain thought the bird had flown away, and this made him happy. His plan had worked. But then he heard the flapping noise again. Quieter now, and slower, too, not flap, 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 like before. And when he followed it, he found the bird lying on its side in the muddy grass. He could see its little chest going up and down as if it was panting. He wondered if it was just tired after all the chirping and just wanted to sleep now.
Romy, what the hell are you doing?
It was Maman's voice. Romain's heart sank. He turned toward her. She was looking around, at the barrel on the ground, the wet, muddy grass, the stains on his jeans where the water had splashed him.
What's going on here, Romy?
She peered over his shoulder.
What's that done there?
She took a step forward, careful where she put her feet, and looked down into the grass behind him.
What the—
By now the flapping noise had stopped, too. Mama took a quick couple of steps back, away from the bird, putting one of her sandals right in the mud.
Romy, I ask you a question. Answer me. What did you do?
It was drowning, Mama, he said, looking up at her. The bird was drowning, but now it's not anymore.
Papa told him about the sleepover school the very next day. It'll be fun, Papa said. They were on the rowboat out on the lake, eating chocolate bars with footballers on them that Papa had brought home from the city. You'll do your schoolwork and play with your friends and eat dinner and sleep all in the same place. It'll be like being on holiday.
But there's no school on holiday, Romain said.
Yes, well, look, Romy, it's hard for your mother, okay? Being here all week without me, trying to look after the three of you by herself, we need to figure out a way to help her.
Send Jean to sleepover school, then. He'd love to go. He'd get to stay in bed even longer, because school would be right there.
He's too young to go now. It's a big boy's school.
Please, Papa, I don't want to go. I want to stay here, and if I go there, I won't be here when you are.
Papa looked away, out over the lake.
Well, I'll try to talk to your mother, Romy, okay? I'll try. I'll see what I can do. But you'll have to do something for me in return. You'll have to start being good, really good, all the time, no matter what. Like Jean. And if you can manage that for, say, a whole month, then we'll see about school.
But Jean isn't good, he just pretends to be.
Papa frowned.
What do you mean?
He's just good to get things. Like yesterday, Mama said whoever ate all their dinner would get some ice cream, so Jean ate all his dinner to get the ice cream, and then Mama said he was good, but he wasn't. He just wanted the ice cream.
Did you eat all your dinner?
Romain trailed his fingers in the water, watching the ripples they made.
No.
Why not?
Because I don't like ice cream.
Papa looked at him funny for a second and then laughed.
Okay, Romy, he said. Fair enough, but what do you think? Are you going to be a good little boy for me? For your maman? Will you promise?
Romain really didn't want to go away to sleepover school, so he promised Papa that he would try his best. At first it was easy. Come Monday morning, he got dressed without delay and brushed his teeth before going downstairs. He ate all his breakfast, without complaining that the cornflakes were soggy, even though they were really soggy. And when he was done, he brought his and Jean's empty bowls to the sink. He left for school before Maman had to tell him, and while he was there he stayed quiet and in his seat. He didn't listen to the teachers. He never did. But Maman wouldn't know that. The teachers didn't even know. After school, he walked straight home without stopping, and as soon as he got in, he changed out of his uniform and hung it up in the wardrobe. But then, in the afternoon, things started to go wrong. Papa had told him to be good like his brother, so Romain started watching Jean to see what he did, so he could copy him. They would both be pretending then, but things would be easier for Maman, and Romain wouldn't have to go away to any awful sleepover school. He watched from the doorway while Maman sat down to look at the TV. After a while, Jean left his toy trains abandoned on the floor and climbed up beside her on the sofa. He snuggled up against Maman, who smiled at him and put an arm around his shoulders and gave him a squeeze. Watching them gave Romain an ache in his belly. Maman never hugged him like that. He hadn't really thought about it before, but he realized now that he wanted her to. So he went to the sofa and climbed up on Maman's other side and smiled at her exactly as Jean had. Maman didn't hug him or squeeze him. She looked away from him and got all stiff instead. A few minutes later, she told Romain to go sit on the armchair across the room instead on his own. Romain didn't know what he had done wrong. Soon after that, it was dinner time. Chicken stew, Romain's least favorite. It looked like the muddy water from the lake, and it would taste like it, too. Maman never made anything nice. Dessert was chocolate mousse in pots, but only if their plates were clean. Romain didn't like chocolate mousse, and he would probably feel sick if he tried to clear his plate, but he remembered what Papa had said. He was supposed to be good. He was supposed to do what Jean did. So when Jean clapped his hands and said,
"It's my favorite, Maman,"
Romain did exactly the same a moment later. Maman turned to stare at him.
"What are you doing, Romy?" she asked. "What is this? What are you up to now?"
"Copying Jean," Romain said, because that was the truth.
"Copying? Why?"
"Because Papa said to."
"Papa?"
Maman said.
"Because Papa said to?"
She sounded as though she was making fun of him. Romain wasn't sure what he was supposed to say now, so he said nothing. He stayed quiet for the rest of the meal. Maman did too. He cleaned his plate but didn't get any mousse, which was good because he didn't want it anyway. Afterward, while Maman was doing the dishes in the kitchen, Miki started crying. He was only a baby, so he was always in his cot in the living room. And now Jean and Romain couldn't hear the TV over him. Jean went into the kitchen and asked Maman to turn up the TV, but she said no and told him to make his baby brother quiet instead. Jean went back to the cot and held Miki's hand and made funny faces, but Miki didn't stop crying. He just started doing it louder. So Romain tried. He had seen Maman make Miki quiet lots of times. Whenever he was crying, she would take him out of his cot and hold him in her arms and walk back and forth across the floor, shaking him up and down and saying, "Shh," a lot. Miki was heavier than Romain thought he would be, and his arms got tired right away, but he remembered his promise to Papa, so he did it anyway, and it worked. After a few minutes, Miki stopped crying. He looked as if he had fallen asleep. Careful not to wake him up again, Romain gently put him back in his cot and covered him with a blanket. But when Maman came into the room a while later, she wasn't happy at all. She looked at Miki and started shaking her head and saying, "Non!" a lot. And then, when she picked him up, she started screaming and crying. And then she knelt on the floor with Miki in her arms and shouted at Romain,
"What have you done this time, you evil little shit? Oh, God! And to think I was out here feeling guilty about you. Oh, God, no, please, no. What have you done?"
Papa was called and told to come home right now, and doctors came in an ambulance for Miki, and Mrs. Laurier came from next door to bring Jean and Romain over to her house, and a week later Romain got sent to sleepover school anyway. And Papa didn't talk to him at all in the car the whole way there. Even though Romain had kept his promise, he had tried his best. All Romain wanted was to be a good little boy. He just couldn't figure out how.
Adam. I always knew when someone was outside our apartment because the building had a tell. Whenever the fire door at the end of the hall was opened, our front door got pulled outward, the wood meeting wood in a loud clunk. Some kind of suction thing. When I heard it that Tuesday evening, I held my breath, waiting for a key to turn in the lock, or one of my neighbor's doorbell to sound. But neither sound came. There was only a pair of voices whispering furiously in the hall. I tiptoed to the front door and looked through the peephole. Morsi and Rose were on the other side. I turned my head and pressed an ear to the door. "You have to tell him," Morsi was saying. "You know it's the right thing to do." "I don't have to do anything." "But you should. Sarah's my best friend. And I'm his. You tell him then." "Well, maybe I will. Maybe I'll move back out. Rose, please. I'm sorry. I just don't know what to do here. What are we supposed to do?" The talking stopped. I put my eye back to the peephole and saw them hugging. When they broke apart, Morsi kissed Rose on the cheek and then Rose reached for the doorbell. I opened the door just as she pressed it. "I thought I heard voices out here," I said. I turned and walked into the kitchen without another word, sensing a silent exchange of meaningful glances behind my back. Footsteps on the hall's hardwood floor followed me. Someone closed the front door and snapped the lock into place. I took a seat at the head of the kitchen table. Morsi sat on my right, Rose next to him. I looked to Rose. Everyone always said she and Sarah could be sisters. They looked so much alike. Blue eyes, brown hair with blonde highlights, small, full mouths. But that evening, nothing about Rose was familiar. Not when she was sitting in our kitchen with no Sarah in sight. I don't know where she is, Adam, she said. Not if she's not at that hotel. Really, I don't. But you know more than I do about where she's been. I don't know anything. Not for sure. You know who she's with. Rose looked to Morsi for help. What's going on, Ad? He asked me. What's happened? I told him about not being able to get through to Sarah's phone, about Jack and Maury not hearing from her either, about the one-night stay at the hotel and the pre-booking of a middle seat on the plane. The hotel says they don't even do conferences, I said. And when Maureen and Jack called Anna Buckley, Rose's head snapped towards me. They called her office? Oh, it gets much worse than that. They're completely freaking out. If they don't hear from her soon, they'll probably call Interpol to launch an international missing persons operation. The colour drained from Rose's face until the pink powder on her cheeks stood out on her blue-white skin. But why? Because they think something terrible has happened to their daughter. I heard my voice rise. Has it, Rose? Has something terrible happened? This wasn't how it was supposed to go. How what wasn't? I can't tell you. Rose's eyes blurred with tears. I'm Sarah's friend. I turned to Morsi and said, and I thought you were mine. You have to tell him, Morsi said to Rose. This is Sarah's fault, not yours. She shouldn't have put you in this position. Just tell him what you know and let her pick up the pieces when she gets back. But I can't. Do you think she'd want her parents to be worried about her like this? Morsi said. We have only two possible outcomes now. Which one would she prefer? He put an arm around Rose's shoulders, pulled her toward him, whispered in her ear. Just tell him what you know, lovely. You can't do anything else. I hadn't been around them much since they got together. I'd never seen them like this. He called her lovely? I felt a pang of regret that I'd never thought of calling Sarah that. What would I be calling her now, after this? What was this? Okay, Rose said. She sniffed, wiped at her eyes, slipped out from under Morsi's arm, sat up straight and looked at me. Sarah is in Barcelona, but not for work. That was just... A pause. That was just her cover story. Her cover story? I knew then that everything was about to change. Adam, Rose said. This may hurt. She paused before she spoke again. And while that beat felt like eternity at the time, there is nothing I wouldn't do to go back to it now. Now, ignorance seems like a nice place to hang out. Although I didn't know it then, that pause marked the end of my before and the beginning of this awful after. A moment of silence that the universe had the good manners to observe before it tore the fabric of my life to shreds. Sarah's seeing someone else, Rose said. I honestly think my heart stopped, just for a couple of beats. I don't know much about him, she went on, in a rush now that she had blown the dam. I do know that he's American and he's married, or was, I'm not sure which. She met him through work. He lives in Dublin, I think. I don't know his name. She just called him the American. My heart cranked back up, making up for lost time now. Harder, louder. The noise of it in my own ears was deafening. Couldn't Morsi and Rose hear that thumping? They started texting each other, Rose said, emailing, things like that. This was maybe 2-3 months ago. It was innocent at first. They met for coffee a few times, then... Well, I don't know all the details. Sarah felt bad enough as it was without gossiping about it to me. But seriously, Adam, how long did you expect her to wait? I wanted to ask, wait for what? But didn't feel confident that I could speak just yet. She didn't want to hurt you, Rose went on, and she didn't want to leave you alone to fend for yourself. She cares about you so much, Adam. You don't even know how much. I told her if she wasn't feeling the same as she had before, she should leave. That if she felt like you two are more friends than anything else, that you should break up. But you know what she said? She said she couldn't do that to you. She was tearing up just at the thought. But then your script sold. Rose shifted in her seat, glanced at Morsi before continuing. You'd have your own money. You could afford to get your own place. Your career would be taking off. Sarah wouldn't have to worry about you. But there was still some waiting to do, and I just think Sarah couldn't wait anymore, okay? She'd waited long enough. He had to go to Barcelona for work, and he asked Sarah to go with him. She said she would. It was time to start thinking about her for a change. She'd tell you she was going to a conference and call in sick to the office. She didn't say anything to Jack and Maureen because they'd only be asking questions. She rarely sees them during the week anyway. She'd only be gone for a few days. They could speak on the phone and not even know she wasn't here. She didn't... Rose bit her lip. She didn't want to have to tell any more lies than she had to. Stop, I finally managed to say. Stop talking. Scenes from the past few weeks were flashing through my mind in a sped-up slideshow, looking all wrong and feeling strange. Sarah and I had been together for 10 years, lived together for the past 8. Almost the only time we didn't spend in each other's company was when she was at work, and yet I hadn't the slightest inkling that anything like this could be going on. I thought I knew everything about her, everything about her life. How had this happened without my noticing? When had it? Was I just that stupid, or was she just that good? Sarah's face, framed by her new short hair, looking up at me. I would never abandon you. You're wrong about one thing, though, Rose said to Morsi. This isn't Sarah's fault. She looked to me. Adam, you know I think you're a nice guy, a good guy, everyone does. But what the hell have you been doing for the last 10 years? Chasing your dreams, yeah, we know, but at Sarah's expense. And I don't just mean financially. What about her dreams? Did you ever think about those? Did you ask her about them? Did you even consider that she might have some too? I never understood that about you. You've always seemed to think you're the only one with a dream and that everyone else is just happy to settle. Rose, Morsi said, stop. I got up from the table, went to the kitchen sink and stood looking out the window. We were 3 floors up on a hill overlooking a city that mostly liked to stick to 1 or 2 stories. Roofs and spires spread out before me in gentle rolling hills before scrambling up the sharp rise on the other side of the river valley. How many nights had Sarah and I sat, wrapped together in a blanket on our tiny balcony, looking at that same view and talking about the future? About our dreams? Many, many nights. But when had we last done it? We had a deal. Sarah had supported me these past few years, and from now on, in exchange for that, I would take care of her forever. The first stage payment from the script sale would be in my bank account within a fortnight, and the very first thing I planned to buy was a ring. And Sarah knew that, didn't she? It was Rose who hadn't a clue. She saw Sarah maybe once a week. I lived with her. She slept in my arms. We were the ones sharing a life. This had to be some kind of awful misunderstanding. All we needed to do was get Sarah on the phone. She'd clear everything up. "When did you last speak to her?" I asked, still looking out the window. "Sunday morning," Rose said. "I sent her a text message and she texted me back. She was at the airport." I saw Sarah walking in the terminal doors, waving goodbye to me, kissing him hello. I gripped the edge of the countertop. "No." "Have you tried calling her since?" "I tried a few times after you texted me," Rose said, "but I went straight to voicemail. But then Morsi said she told you she wasn't going to disturb you because you were doing your rewriting thing. I think the phone is probably off. I think she turned it off. On purpose." "You gave her the perfect excuse to do that." "What am I going to tell Maureen and Jack?" "We obviously can't tell them about any of this, so I was thinking, how about I call them and say I've heard from her, that her phone is broken or something, and that she's sorry for worrying them, and then she'll talk to them when she gets back. You can intercept her at the airport on Thursday and explain why we did that. You're still planning to meet her there, aren't you?" "You'll have to. And you can't tell her I told you this. You'll have to make something up. I mean it, Adam. She's my best friend." There was silence then. When I turned around, Rose and Morsi were looking at each other, hands clasped together on the tabletop. "You've always seemed to think you were the only one with a dream." "But Sarah was my dream. None of the rest of it mattered without her. This was all for her, for us. She knew that. But had she stopped wanting it?" Another thought. Sarah. My Sarah. Naked in a hotel bed. A faceless man on top of her. Touching her skin. I shut my eyes, but the image wouldn't go away. I turned back around just in time to throw up into the sink. Thursday at lunchtime. Thick grey clouds pregnant with rain hung over the city, threatening to unload at any moment. I parked in the airport's multi-story garage and followed the covered walkway into the terminal. Inside, the noise of heels and wheels meeting the hard floor blended with indecipherable PA announcements and distant muzak. The bank of screens suspended from the ceiling just inside the main doors flickered as I stopped to study them, changing the listing for Sarah's flight home from expected 13:15 to landed 13:05. She was here. I remember thinking that. I made a beeline for the coffee kiosk. I needed a caffeine fix after a second night of broken, fitful sleep, tormented by what Rose had told me the day before yesterday, unsure what to do about it or even whether to believe it. I had decided just before dawn that all I could do was wait to see Sarah, wait to give her a chance to tell me herself what was going on. Maybe not all was lost yet. Or maybe it had been for ages. I just didn't know. I took my coffee to an empty chair in the first row of seats facing the arrivals doors. The last barrier between airside passengers and the landside public waiting for them. Sitting down, I pulled out my phone and dialed Sarah's number for the umpteenth time this morning. Straight to voicemail. Again. I didn't leave a message. Again. When was she going to turn it back on? Before I could relock the screen, the phone vibrated with an incoming call. Jack. He was talking before I could even get the phone to my ear. Is she there? Is she with you? Maureen saw on the internet that her flight has landed. I had vetoed Rose's plan to lie to Maureen and Jack that Sarah had made contact with us, informing us of a lost or broken phone. It seemed both an unnecessary evil and too good a deed to do for someone who had lied to me. Even though I was still holding out hope that there was an innocent reason for it all and Rose just had an overactive imagination. Instead, I had convinced Sarah's parents that the simplest explanation was the most likely one. Sarah had a problem with her phone and we should just sit tight until Thursday lunchtime and wait for her to come off the plane. Which was supposed to be now. It just landed, I said. She hasn't come through yet. You'll get her to call us as soon as you meet her. It'll be the first thing I say to her. He thanked me and ended the call. I meant what I said. The most unbelievable thing about all this was how Sarah was treating her parents. Hadn't she realized they would worry when they couldn't contact her? Why hadn't she contacted them? It was unbelievably selfish. Although that would make two of us if I believed what Rose had told me. The coffee sloshed around in my empty stomach. I dumped the half-full cup in the nearest bin and went to stand at the railing in front of the arrivals doors. A minute or two later, passengers started coming through. Would they both be on this flight? Sarah had a window seat coming back, but maybe that was just because they couldn't book two seats together, or they had swapped over and he had booked the middle one. Would I recognize him? Would he recognize me? Sarah knew I would be waiting, so they wouldn't be coming through hand in hand. They would pretend to be strangers, but they would probably struggle with the act. I studied faces and body language, looking for clues to which passenger was the other guy having sex with my girlfriend. The first to come through was a prime candidate. Attractive man, maybe 5 years older than I, pulling a small trolley case with a bulky laptop bag slung over his shoulder. As he passed me, I saw the airport code on his luggage tag, BCN. Sarah's flight. His eyes darted around as if he was looking for someone, and he moved fast. This could be the guy. But then he spotted someone holding a GD investment sign and broke into a smile, waving at them. What was I doing? Sarah wasn't cheating on me. She would never. She loved me. I would never abandon you. The rest of the passengers came spilling out in much the same order that they must have boarded the plane on the other side. First class, well-dressed and relaxed. They had only carry-on because they knew how to travel, and there was no one to meet them but hired drivers. Next, harried young parents with buggies and bags that outnumbered the kids, who were on their last nerve after a week of round-the-clock family time. Then the masses, a mix of travellers, vacationers and low-fare opportunists, sunburned but mostly smiling, carrying copies of the in-flight magazine, tablet computers and clear, sealed plastic bags of duty-free purchases. Finally, the crew. 4 men and 3 women, all wearing bright green Aer Lingus uniforms and an air of superiority, the men flashing their straight white teeth and the women modelling various shades of harsh red lipstick. None of the passengers took any special notice of me or appeared to be acting strange, and none of them was Sarah. I waited another 10 minutes, but no one else came through the doors except for flak-jacketed airport staff and a woman with no bags, who started moaning loudly about lost luggage and delays to the man who was there to meet her. I waited another 15. I imagined Sarah on the other side of the frosted glass, staring in disbelief at the phone she had just switched back on, blinking through tears at the influx of text messages, emails, and notifications of missed calls. Devastated at the pain she had inadvertently caused with her silence, wondering what the hell I must be thinking, trying to find the words to begin her apology. Or maybe just confused to find that she hadn't gotten away with her lies. Don't. I shook my head as if to physically dislodge the thought. She wouldn't. This is Sarah we're talking about. My Sarah. I tried her phone again, straight to voicemail, but then she could be on the phone to Maureen and Jack, and I opened WhatsApp. Still only one checkmark. I started to feel self-conscious. I had been standing in the same spot for a half an hour now and hadn't stopped checking my phone. If any CCTV cameras were trained on this spot, whoever was monitoring them had undoubtedly picked me out by now as a potential suspected something or other. How much longer should I wait? Cork Airport was small. Yes, the Celtic Tiger era architecture was impressive, but I'd been in the glorified sheds of really old airfields and seen more gates than here. Each year, when they announced the passenger numbers, I wondered how they managed to funnel everyone through just eight of them. Here, there were no endless corridors, no warnings about allowing enough time to get to your gate, no need for a single moving sidewalk in the whole building. If you could waltz through passport control and you only had carry-on, it was a five-minute walk from the tarmac to the taxi rank. So where was she? I began looking around for someone who might be able to tell me whether Sarah had been on the plane in the first place. A middle-aged man in a high-visibility vest walked past. I stepped toward him. "Excuse me," I said. I explained that I had been expecting someone who was supposed to be on the Barcelona flight but hadn't appeared. Was there someone I could talk to? He pulled a walkie-talkie from his belt and barked jargon into it, then translated the squawk that came bursting back out. All the passengers from the Barcelona flight were through. They had cleared immigration and customs, and a cleaning crew was already aboard the plane. "You're sure you have the right flight, son?" he asked. "Maybe she missed it." He shrugged and walked off. My phone rang. A blocked number. Here we go. "Hello. Hey, buddy, it's Dan Goldberg in New York. Can you talk?" I winced. Dan was the agent who had brokered the script sale. The same agent who, right about now, was surely wondering where the hell the rewritten script was. He wanted to see it before I sent it to the studio, and the studio was expecting it in 10 days. "Not just now, Dan, to be honest. I wanted to check in, you know, since I haven't heard from you." A pause. "At all?" "I know, it's just... it's your first time. It's imperative that you deliver on time." "I will." "You're going to show it to me first?"
"Yes."
"You won't send it directly to them?"
"No."
"When will I see it?"
"Soon. Dan, sorry, but I kind of have a family emergency going on at the moment."
"Really? Fuck, is everything all right? I'm sure everything will be fine, but I just can't talk right now. Sorry, I'll call you back as soon as I can." "Is there any..." I hung up on him. Then I looked down at my phone in surprise, as if I couldn't believe what I had done. I had waited 10 years for someone like him to start calling me, and now I was hanging up on him. What was I thinking? But then my phone rang with Jack's number yet again, and I remembered that on my list of new and pressing problems, Dan was currently sitting at number 2. I'd call him just as soon as I spoke to Sarah, as soon as I knew what the hell was going on. I waited another 10 minutes. I tried Sarah's phone again on the way back to my car, slowing down the closer I got, hoping my phone would ring and I'd have reason to turn back around. It didn't. I drove back to the apartment with an empty passenger seat and new company, a question in my mind, repeating over and over like a snippet of lyric on a gouged-out CD. Where is she? Where is she? Where is she? Jack rang me 3 more times during the 10-minute drive from the airport to the apartment. I didn't answer. I didn't know what to say to him now, or what to do next, or even what to think. I pulled into the first empty parking spot outside our building, killed the engine, and called Rose. "She wasn't on the flight," I said as soon as she answered.
"What do you mean? I mean, she wasn't on the flight. She didn't come home. She hasn't come home. There was a long silence on the line. Rose? You there? Yeah, I just don't know, Adam. Maybe she missed it. Is there another flight from Barcelona today? I don't know. I'll check. Where are you now? I just got home. Listen, that stuff you said about Sarah and the American guy. Yeah? Is there any chance? What? How sure are you about it? Could she have been lying or something? Making it up? Or maybe they're just friends and you misunderstood. You said she didn't talk about it much with Adam. A long sigh. I'm sorry. I really am. And I'm sorry for the way that I told you and some of the things I said, but she is seeing someone else. She met him through work and she went to Barcelona with him. That's all I know. But she was coming back today. Of course she was. She's getting ready to... Another sigh. To leave you. God, I'm sorry. This must be awful for you to hear. I feel terrible, I do. But she is. And anyway, where else would... I took the phone from my ear and pressed the virtual red button to end the call. I couldn't listen to it anymore. Something clutched in my chest as I realized that the last time I would hold or kiss or touch Sarah had probably already happened. I would never get to do it again. There went my entire future, destroyed by a dead phone, an online banking password, and a missed flight. Sarah, what have you done? What have I done to you? I ached for her. I wanted to hold her, kiss her, touch her, to have her next to me in the car, to reach over and squeeze her knee at a red light. I needed to speak to her. The list of little things I wanted to share with her, the anecdotes and observations and jokes I'd been saving up while she was away was already long, and I wouldn't be able to remember them all for much longer. I missed her. I just missed her. Had been missing her for the past 4 days. I hadn't paid the feeling much attention because I knew it was temporary, that it was going to come to an end. Today, supposedly. And now, all of a sudden, there was no end in sight. If what Rose said was true, my Sarah might be gone forever. Now every evening and weekend and birthday and fortnight's holiday and special occasion was stretching out in front of me, empty and cold and dark. A drowning depth of loneliness. An endless abyss. I had been with Sarah so long I could barely remember what it felt like to live without her. I didn't know if I could. I didn't want to have to try. But then... Her and a faceless him together in a hotel room. My phone buzzed in my hand. Jack calling again. I put the phone on silent, slipped it into my pocket and got out of the car. I typed the entry code into the keypad for our block and waited for the electronic click that signaled success. I pushed the door open, blinked in the dim light of the lobby, and after a second noticed something in our cubbyhole. We didn't have locked letterboxes, only open.